Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is an Empowerment Hour. As you will see, a newsmaker guest is dealing with the topic that is current, something happening immediately, a shorter segment, generally from 5 to 7 minutes. We have two. First, we'll be talking with Dr. Ellen Brown about what is actually happening concerning Europe, America, our debt, and derivatives. And why is it that no one chose to ask the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, any really hard questions? You'll have a really good understanding of what is happening with gold, silver, where you should put your money in just a few moments. Then I'll be speaking with Cindy Bevington. She is a multi-award-winning reporter for KPC Media Group. She's the one who originally broke the story about the lead researchers in Merck's Gardasil trials, Dr. Diana Harper, then at Dartmouth Medical School, who raised alarm about the efficacy and safety of the vaccine and who called it, quote, a big public health experiment. Mind you, this was the inventor of it. Well, that didn't stop the government, and with the, especially the Democrats on this one, from pushing to get mandatory vaccines. We've been arguing everywhere we can, look at the evidence. There's no safety or efficacy. To the contrary, it's extremely dangerous. It's killing at least 104 that we know of, and probably more. We'll find that out today. And has injured tens of thousands of young women and men. Well, now South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley vetoed, said no to a Democrat-sponsored bill to provide seventh graders with free HPV vaccine. And good for her on this issue. There are a lot of issues I would be on the opposite side of her, but on this one, just like with Ron Paul, when he's on the right side of an issue, let's support him. When he's on the wrong side, challenge him. It's that simple. So congratulations to Nikki Haley, governor of South Carolina, for standing up. Why aren't the other governors, Mayor Cuomo, why isn't the governor of New York, Cuomo, or Christie from New Jersey doing the same? We will talk about that in a newsmaker segment. And then tomorrow, a brand new, in-depth, original investigative report, a white paper on Gardasil vaccines. We'll be sending this out. We hope you will send it out to everyone you know. Let them know that this is a dangerous, irresponsible, unscientific public health experiment. And that is based upon the person who actually invented the vaccine. Also today, they are voting in Congress, in the Senate, on labeling genetically engineered food. We need you to support the labeling of genetically engineered food if you believe it should be. If you don't, then clearly you won't be supporting it. But to help you understand the truth of it, I'll be sharing a 9-minute commentary on the Senate floor this week from Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. Plus, I'll be bringing the latest in the area of science, showing you that genetic engineering, all of it, is dangerous, it is unpredictable, and we shouldn't have it in our foods, but at least we should know it's there and label it. Also, the latest on new information that you have not heard about what the United States government knew about the radiation monitoring immediately after the Fukushima, what the Japanese government knew and what they both did. I don't know that we'll have time today, but if we do, I'm going to get into some depth on the coup of this year, how I believe that the United States has been on the track of becoming a very dangerous place. I'll explain why and give you the actual scholarly, historically accurate, lulls and bells, what they mean, that have not gotten anyone's attention or most people's attention. There are some people aware of that. And why we should pay attention to the third-party candidates, because they are all fully against these and would repeal them. As you see, we have a lot to share in all areas. So let's begin. First up, everyone needs healthy oils in their diet. The question is, what constitutes a healthy oil? Now let's go back, if you're a baby boomer in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and we were told, have those good sunflower oil, soybean oil, canola oil, corn oil. And that's what most people had, not olive oil. Now the latest research shows that we were doing it just the opposite. We were taking in the oils that were derived, the fatty acids were derived from a very toxic substance called HNE. That stands for 4-hydroxytrans-2-nonanil. And that is a byproduct that is produced when polyunsaturated oils are heated at very high temperatures. They're also clarified. That's why your oil historically has had almost a watery look. Whereas real oil that is unfiltered and cold-pressed, it'll have all kinds of little sediments in it. And most people don't want anything with a sediment. They think it's a contaminant. It is not. In fact, once you've bleached the oils, filtered them, highly pasteurized them, there's nothing good in them, just bad. So understand that the so-called healthy oils that we've been told to eat are the worst oils that we could take into our body. That increases lipid peroxidation. That allows the toxic HNE to get into the cells, and that imbalances our biochemistry. A study done at the Center for Genetics in Washington, D.C. found that, quote, excessive amounts of the omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids, the oils I just mentioned, would promote pathogenesis of many diseases, including cardiovascular disease, cancer, autoimmune, and inflammatory diseases. The healthiest oils that we should be consuming, we're not promoting. That would be the organic cold-pressed flaxseed oil, chia oil, hemp oil, macadamia oil. Those are the good oils. Walnut oil, cold-pressed, and olive oil, extra virgin, organic, first-press olive oil. So, just remember, if you want good oils to prevent cancer, don't take the omega-6s. Now, another thing that we should be consuming more of is maca, M-A-C-A. Now, maca comes from the Peruvian rainforest, and we haven't done a whole lot with it, but it's been a very popular ancient plant. It's been used for a long time. And it's a root. It's considered a superstar. Why? Because it improves your energy. It gives you greater stamina. For men, it really enhances your libido. And for menopausal women, it can balance your hormones naturally. It's a part of the what we call brassica family, and it's cultivated in the Andes and has been over for 2,500 years. But you won't see it most of the time because it's grown at about 10,000 feet above sea level. It is the highest altitude crop in the world. When you look at maca, that is now having a bit of a resurgence because of a Peruvian biologist, a Dr. Popovici, who published some studies showing that it increased fertility and energy, endurance, and now it has aphrodisiac qualities. So the other scientists came in to see if this was true, and indeed it was true. So you can get it in a powder and get the raw powder. And it's easy to get. You can also get pomegranate powder as a powder. But it is great for our general and sexual well-being and increases male libido. It can also reduce anxiety and depression and improve libido in postmenopausal women. And it's an adaptogen, just like ginseng is an adaptogen. So we'll want to take it. How does it work? Well, we believe it works by stimulating the hypothalamus and the pituitary glands, which are then responsible for regulating the other glands in our body. And especially when you balance the adrenal, thyroid, pancreatic, ovarian, and testicular glands, you're going to be in far better health. It's okay in nutrients. It does have some sulfur in it. It's not a superstar as far as nutrients, but it is a superstar as far as what it does inside the body. So get it in. Now, there's been a question about, does the sun help or hurt pancreatic cancer? And here is the latest on this from the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. It says, quote, action points. Note that this study was published as an abstract and presented at a conference. And then it goes on to talk about the three factors related to sunlight exposure reduced the risk of pancreatic cancer by 49%. That's important. So that's why it is important to get your sunlight, because you're getting your vitamin D, and you need that in order to help prevent different types of cancers. Also, I'm a big believer in eating and juicing apples, and especially the skin. This is the latest from Science Daily and published in PLOS ONE, major scientific journal. Here's what it says. Apple peels boost the brown fat and reduces obesity. This is from the study. It says, obesity and its associated problems, quote, such as diabetes and fatty liver disease, are increasingly common global health concerns. A new study from the University of Iowa shows that a natural substance found in apple peels, that's the skin, can partially protect mice, and we assume humans in this one, from obesity and some of its harmful effects. The findings suggest that this substance, known as ursolic acid, U-R-S-O-L-I-C, ursolic acid, reduces obesity and its associated health problems by increasing the amount of muscle and brown fat, two tissues recognized for their calorie-burning properties. So that's good research. And finally, eat less meat and farm efficiently to tackle climate change. This is from University of Exeter. Quote, we need to eat less meat and recycle our waste to rebalance the global carbon cycle and reduce our risk of dangerous levels of climate change. New research from the University of Exeter shows that if today's meat-eating habits continue, the predicted rise in the global population could spell ecological disaster. But changes in our lifestyle and our farming could make space for growing crops for bioenergy and carbon storage. So that's the message. And this was published in the current Journal of Energy and Environmental Sciences. Why do I feel this is so important? Because three things. One, when you eat meat, any kind of meat, you have to cook it or you run the risk of massive parasitic and worm infestation, and that could cause your problems and kill you. So, but in the process of cooking the meat, you're changing the protein in such a way that you create a carcinogen. It is called a heterocyclic amine. Then most people don't eat meat alone. They'll eat it with a potato, like a french fry, or a bun, like a hamburger or hot dog, or a piece of bread or a roll. And as a result, that has to be cooked in such a way that it creates a brown crust. That creates another cancer-causing set of chemicals, acrylamides. By combining meat with a bun or protein with carbohydrate that is refined, you have a double negative that also creates a higher percentage of colorectal cancer and autotoxemia. So we're simply getting sicker by eating that type of diet. On the other hand, we now see an enormous increase in those people throughout the world, mainly in Brazil, China, India, South Korea, Russia, that say, me too. If you in the United States represent only 4% of the population of the world, but you consume 25% of the resources, you have the highest amount of meat in the diet, and eggs in the diet, and fish in the diet, and cereals in the diet, why can't we? And on one level, it's completely logical. And I would not disagree with their logic, though I would disagree with their common sense. Their economies, the ones I just mentioned, have been the fastest growing economies in the world in the past 8 years. Where one time there were only two giant economies, actually three. There was America first, Japan second, Germany and the European Union third. I don't say Germany separate from the European Union, but Germany was the leading country. But when you add all of the European Union, it exceeds the United States and Japan combined. But then Japan went through a 20-year recession, which it's still in, but we didn't know because its banks were giving zero interest loans or 1% interest loans and no collateral to its corporations, because there's an inbred incestuous relationship between the corporations in Japan and the government in Japan. But they kept driving the economic cycle and giving us lots of money. $800 billion they bought of our T-bills so we could continue to think we were rich when we weren't. Now, all those people who work so hard and sacrifice for decades, their countries have given them quality education. China's educational system for those who attend it, and South Korea's, exceed that in the United States. Quite frankly, a child in the United States is not in the same league in academic excellence as these other countries, especially in science and math and other topics. However, they also did not bend the curve when it came to looking at what was going on, and that's important. Meaning, in the United States, because we were privatizing and profitizing off of our educational system, $1 trillion a year, we said, okay, if you get an F, instead of finding out why and maybe working with you and getting you the kind of tutorials that you need or holding you back so you actually learn as historically was what was done, we're now going to make your F a C, and we're going to make your A a C, but we'll give you the credit for the A. But now the A and the A-plus student, the excessively smart student, has to learn at the same level as the excessively lazy or intellectually challenged student. Well, that just screws everything up. I mean, who wants to be a part of that system? The trouble is, that's what we created. Other countries did not. So now you know why we have, when someone says they graduate with an A, well, at one time, that might have meant something. Today, it doesn't mean diddly squat. In any case, I'm just sharing this with you because now all those countries, all those hundreds of millions of people, when you add up the number of highly educated, new, upper-middle-class people and working-class people in China and in Japan and in South Korea and Brazil and in India, you're now up to, you ready for this? 750 million people who now can afford meat and everything that we consume they want. Well, when they do that, they have to grow more soybeans, genetically engineered, which means they have to take vast areas of rainforest, cut them down, burn them down, and then grow soybeans to feed the cattle. They have to use growth-stimulating hormones in the cattle or the pigs. And there's almost no thought of what happens to the environment. Can we just keep doing this indefinitely, cutting and burning and growing? Shouldn't we be working towards showing the danger that, yes, we did have all this consumption, but look at us. We're burnt out, we're diseased, we're obese, we're not healthy, and we're broke. You have plus savings at 27% in India, as high as 49% in China. We have negative 1%. So why are you using us as a model when you were wiser in many respects, even though you were poorer. So up comes the standard of living, and that's why I'm hoping that we're able, through all of the efforts of so many millions of people around the world, to say, let us not go for a big meat diet. Let's consume what Americans consume. Let's supersize everything. That kind of gluttony didn't help us, and I hope they see that. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world who are listening now. Thank you for tuning in. Today is an activist day. After my guests, I'll be asking a call to action. One of those I'm going to be asking you to pay careful attention to, because today your senator is going to vote for or against GMO labeling. And I believe that America should know what it's eating. I hope you concur. And if you do, then we can stop big agribusiness and their lobbyists from giving away billions of dollars in federal subsidies to the agribusiness lobby. There are urgent calls needed today. The Senate votes on GMO labeling amendment today. And so we have to get the word out. So I want to say thank you to the Food Democracy Now groups out there. Our listeners have been calling, and I know others are calling, so we're going to ask them to call again today. Tell your senators you support genetically modified labeling, and you want them to support it. And we support Senator Sanders, who introduced Amendment 2310. That's the Consumer's Right to Know About Genetically Engineered Food Act, in an impassioned speech that you're going to hear in a moment. Senator Sanders' words were a welcome relief of reasonable and common sense logic on a topic that has long been plagued by bureaucratic doublespeak. So I'm going to ask you, please call and support Bernie Sanders' labeling of our food, genetically engineered food. All right, that's today. Now, also, I'm going to go over and say hello to, we have two guests. Let's say hello to Dr. Alan Brown. Dr. Brown is an economist and attorney. She is now the president and chairperson of the Public Banking Institute, which is a nonprofit economic venture to find viable, sustainable solutions to America's banking crisis by promoting people-owned state and community banks. She's written extensively about the private financial cartels and the Federal Reserve. Her book, Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free, analyzes in-depth how Wall Street and its hold on Washington control money for their self-interest. She runs the blog webofdebt.com, webofdebt.com. And she is with us today. Nice to have you back with us, Dr. Brown.
Oh, thanks, Gary.
I'm only going to ask you two questions, as this is a newsmaker segment. First, the average American is clueless about what a derivative is, how much the value of these derivatives represent in the current world scheme, and especially just a few banks, like the very bank where the head of that bank, Jamie Dimon, was testifying last week before Congress. Why did no one in that banking panel ask him about, tell us about these derivatives, what is your position on them, what are all the banks' position, meaning how much do you actually hold, how much did you have to put down? Why is there such an astronomical spread between what you put down and versus what you get if something goes in your direction? The public doesn't understand any of this. So just tell us everything about derivatives in an encapsulated way so we, who are not up on this, can see, my goodness, this is a lethal virus in the economic system that we're a part of, and yet no one is doing anything to deal with it. That's my first question.
Okay. Jamie Dimon was supposedly hauled before Congress to be grilled, supposedly, on these $3 billion in losses from from a speculative trade. I mean, he called it hedging, but it's actually speculation, which was should be illegal. But instead, Congress was quite obsequious to the point where John Stewart did a clip on it, poking fun at it, and Matt Taibbi wrote one on why is the Senate groveling before Jamie Dimon. So the theory would be that, of course, J.P. Morgan pays a lot for their campaign contributions, but there's evidently more to it than that. J.P. Morgan holds $57 trillion worth of interest rate swaps, and according to authorities that I cited in my article, there's no counterparty big enough to take the other side of those trades except the U.S. government, which would be the Exchange Stabilization Fund. It's a sort of covert fund that nobody knows anything about, that doesn't have to report to anyone, and it was set up for the purpose of stabilizing the exchange rate of the dollar, in other words, to keep the dollar from going down relative to other dollars. So the way an interest rate swap works is, well, it's quite complicated, but anyway, a derivative in general is just a bet. It's a bet that derives from something else. So you don't have to own the thing in order to bet. Just like if you go to the racetrack and you want to bet on a horse, you don't have to own the horse. So these interest rate swaps, according to my two sources, Rob Kirby and Willie's his last name, I've forgotten his first name. Anyway, they allege that those interest rate swaps were there to protect the very, very low interest rate that we're currently getting on U.S. bonds. We have to keep that, or the government has to keep that rate very low, because if the rate goes up, then we'll be paying a lot more in taxes. We're already paying, like, half of our tax bill goes to, well, this would be our personal income taxes, goes to pay the interest on the federal debt, which, in my opinion, is totally unnecessary. I mean, they should have borrowed that from their own central bank all along, but they don't. They borrow privately, and they have to pay interest on it. So if that rate were to go up, then it would be a huge bite out of the taxpayers, and the taxpayers would complain, and, of course, the administration would get overthrown. And so it's in their interest to protect this very low interest rate, and that's what the interest rate swaps do.
But there's something completely confusing about this and something illogical, and I'd like for you to unravel this mystery. On the one hand, historically, the U.S. Treasury, if it needed to borrow money, it would give it. It would issue the debt at zero interest. Now the Federal Reserve is the place that you go to, but the Federal Reserve has relationships with these major five. Let's say that with a lot of banks, but let's just say the top five. And then when we ask, well, who actually is being paid this $542 billion just in interest each year on the national debt? No one ever answers that question, but when I did some looking, and which you would know, a lot of that's to the banks. Well, hold on. Are these the banks that were bailed out at zero interest? Are these the banks that now have bought up competition with the money we gave them, and that yet we're allowed to continue making outrageous debt purchases? Are these the same banks that don't all actually have to have the money in their possession from the Federal Reserve at zero interest to turn around and get interest on what they're supposedly giving to the U.S. Treasury that we end up paying them? That, to me, sounds like a lack of circular or just completely circular logic. It is stupid. I would like for you to give us your explanation of this, please.
Well, that's true. About half, well, the debt is now over $15 trillion, and about half of it is held by the U.S. government itself, largely in the Social Security Fund. But that would include what's held by the Federal Reserve. And then about $1 trillion is held by the Chinese, and another trillion or so by the Japanese. So you have a lot of, you know, you have individual investors that hold it, so you couldn't just write it off. But what you could do, I think, is just buy it up. What they should do is have the Federal Reserve refinance the whole thing through the Fed at 0% interest, or at any interest you want, because the Fed rebates its profits to the government. But the ultimate source of all of our money is banks. When banks create, when they issue loans, they actually just create that money on their books, and that's where virtually all of our money comes from. So you could trace all those debts ultimately back to the banks. And, of course, the banks now are holding $1.6 trillion in excess reserves on their books, and that's, and they have a big chunk of federal securities.
But they didn't pay for the money in the first place, but they're going to get interest on what they didn't pay for. To me, that seems extremely self-serving. I believe there's just gross conflict of interest. There's this relationship between the Federal Reserve and Jamie Dimon, who sits on the board of the New York Fed. How can you sit on the board of the New York Fed and then give your bank $243 billion and not consider that a conflict of interest?
J.P. Morgan got $55 billion to buy up Bear Stearns in 2008 and bought it up at pennies on the dollar, so it totally recapitalized J.P. Morgan, and it wiped out Bear Stearns and their shareholders. And he was sitting on the board when that decision was made, and that was clear. And he had a big chunk of stock in J.P. Morgan at that time, so he had clear conflict of interest, and there's a statute that specifically makes that illegal and makes it a felony. And nobody calls him on it. I mean, there are a number of crimes. I enumerated a number in my article of things that he could be called on, but he's never called. Elizabeth Warren is bringing legislation right now to get him replaced, or to get any large bank that's regulated by the same board that he sits on to get those bankers removed. But in fact, he's the only one. she'll get some traction out of that.
My last question is this. When we look at what's going on in Europe, and I'm thinking, I can't believe that America's talking head economists and on these television shows are saying, good news, we gave, $125 billion to Spain to help it, and Greece is sitting with between $450 and $600 billion, but it's okay because it has a new government that's going to pay back the money. And I'm thinking, A, we don't give $600 billion to Greece. 90% of that was given back to the banks that had loaned the money in the first place. And also, that is true, 75% of the money that was given to Spain to boost their, to keep their people from running out and taking their funds out of the bank and sending it over to Germany or England, we gave that money back to the same bank. So if we knew the truth of what actually gets into a country and not just additional rollover debt. Secondly, we've done nothing in any country of the 27 European Union countries, the 17 that share the currency, we've done nothing to actually help the average person's wages increase so they have more buying and borrowing power, to help bring down interest on their debts. In some cases, it was as high as 7%, so they'll be in debt in perpetuity, and have done nothing to realign those grossly disproportionate situations where the public debt was minor as a percentage of their gross domestic product until Wall Street came in and got them speculating and got the real estate bubble going, the commercial real estate bubble, the personal real estate bubble, and all these other bubbles that did not exist before Wall Street and the European banks got involved. And yet we don't take that into account. So when you look at the debt in Spain, the debt in Greece, the debt in Ireland, you're not saying, what if we took away all the private debt and looked at how much it actually, the percentage of debt to run their country, to give their pensions, to give their educational system, their medical system, and their government a chance to run. And we'd see they weren't in debt. They weren't terribly in debt. They could have managed. But when you start piling on all these other loans that the banks got and then want to get out with all their profit and exploit it, and we're not being told the truth. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree. I know a woman who's a professor in Italy, and she said that they had no financial problems at all until the rating agencies came in and started saying that they did have a problem, and that caused their debt to be downgraded, which meant the interest rate went up. The interest rate is a huge factor. Greece is now paying 30% interest, which is unbelievable. At 30%, your debt doubles in 2.4 years. And in Greece, for example, they're a blatant example of what you're talking about. The Troika, I think it's the ECB, the IMF, and the European Union, what I'm not sure who the third was, Common Market or something. Anyway, they are lending only enough to Greece to pay the interest on the debt to them, and they're sequestering that money so that it can't go for anything but to pay the interest. So here they are lending money that they get back, which doesn't help Greece at all. The debt keeps going up, and it's not getting into the Greek economy at all. So my proposal on that is they should just issue their own drachmas for internal purposes. I mean, they need more money in the system. The whole euro system is short of funds. It's the nature of a parasitic pyramid scheme that, you know, if all your money comes into the economy as a loan to a bank and you always owe more back than the bank put out there in the first place, you've got to have an expanding money supply in order to cover that interest. And if you don't, they're all going to sink together. I mean, there's just not enough money to, they all owe to each other, and there's just not enough money to pay all that. So they need to get some more money in there. And what they could do is revert to issuing their local currencies for local purposes, or the ECB should issue more money. But what it should do is issue the money directly to the governments. There's a provision in the Lisbon Treaty that says the ECB is not there to serve the government. It's there to serve the banks, and only the banks can borrow from the ECB at this very favorable interest rate that they're giving now, 1%. So
but
the government...
Ellen, the American public does not understand this. They don't understand that when you go into Greece today, the tourist industry is in tatters. One out of every three businesses, when you walk down any street in the capital, in Athens, it's closed. The garbage is piling up. That there is vandalism. There's gangs that are everywhere. I know someone who had their house broken into that was in an affluent neighborhood that had never happened before in their lifetime. And that people are going hungry. The people in Greece that were middle class are now going to garbage places and looking through garbage, like you would expect in a slum within an African community. We have disparity. That's now happening, and yet you'll say, well, didn't we give them $400 billion? We gave the bankers $400 billion. The bankers did, as you said, a computation on a computer. No money actually transferred hands, but now they were indebted. Now you give them 30% interest, and now that comes back, and now the banks are just rolling in money. And then in come the vulture capitalists who say, okay, we want the islands. We want your highways. We want your water. We want your parking meters. We want – and next thing you know – the cost of living to people who are already struggling becomes an insurmountable obstacle, and yet we're not looking at it honestly because we're allowing the American media to dictate all this, and it's the story. They're not telling the truth. My final observation is, do you know currently how much the total derivative position is in the world compared to the world gross domestic product, which is about $75 trillion, meaning of all the countries in the world, if you took all the money they earned each year, it's about $75 trillion. The United States is about $15 trillion. But do you know how much the actual derivative positions are?
The IMF reports 600-some trillion.
Trillion.
But the actual trades are over a quadrillion, which when I was a kid used to be an imaginary number.
1,000 trillions is a quadrillion, but it's 1.2 quadrillion.
Right.
So how in the world can you have the total income be only 1/11th of the total expenses? That means that this is an extraordinarily irresponsible and precarious economic situation. I believe that we should outlaw all derivative trading and just wipe it off the board. After all, they haven't bought anything. And so they can take their money and go home. Otherwise, sooner or later, one of these big derivative positions are going to be coming due, and the American taxpayer is going to have to fund it. And I believe that that should be the final straw that we get nothing. We don't have a home foreclosure moratorium. We got 18 million hungry children in the United States. 48 million are on food stamps. 114 million Americans are at the poverty level. We had 11.2 million home foreclosures. 44 million Americans are on the street. Our true national debt has nothing in the world to do with this fictitious number of $15.3 trillion. You're not taking into account state debt, unfunded or underfunded pensions, which are at $2.3 trillion. You're not taking into account the unfunded or underfunded entitlement programs, and you're not taking in the $16 trillion in personal debt, corporate debt at $14 trillion. You add up all of our total debt, and it's about $140 trillion. And yet we are blaming other countries for economic irresponsibility when they are at 100 to 200% debt to gross domestic product, and we're at 900% debt to gross domestic product. I think that we are absolutely dead wrong in how we're approaching our economic challenge. Final thought from you, Ellen.
Well, I would have to agree with that. I mean, and derivatives, their argument would be that it's rather like fractional reserve lending, that you're not going to have to pay up on all these. You're only going to pay up on the few that default. But what if? I mean, what if that J.P. Morgan has to pay up on that $57 trillion? They certainly don't have $57 trillion.
And that's 3 times, 300% of the gross domestic product that we would have to give to a bank. How obscene.
Yeah, and are we going to underwrite that? That's the thing. We underwrote their commercial loans that went bad, but what about their derivative bets to go bad?
Do you know anyone that would have the courage to stand up against the people to keep them in office and guarantee them their high lecture fees in the future and their campaigns? Chuck Schumer, who was $6.2 million he had received from J.P. Morgan alone, every member of the committee, got a total of over $26 million in campaign? No, we unfortunately would be lied to again. I thank you for being out there and sharing your thoughts with us.
Okay, and thank you for the same.
Ellen Brown, author of a website, webofdebt.com, and a very important book, Web of Debt. Now let's go right over and say hello to our next guest standing by, Cindy Bevington. I gave you her bio earlier. And she has won over 7 dozen awards for her work during her career. And she is here to talk about the newest situation where South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley vetoed a Democrat-sponsored bill to provide seventh graders with free HPV vaccine. And on this single issue, I would agree with the governor. On others, I would challenge her. But Cindy, thank you for being with us today.
Well, hi, Gary. Glad to be back again.
Thank you. Cindy, first, explain to the audience why they should all be concerned about the human papillomavirus and why we should be encouraging our legislators to tell their governors veto any mandatory vaccination with Gardasil.
Well, to begin with, it's very much misunderstood. It's been sold as a cervical cancer vaccine. And it is not a cervical cancer vaccine. It is a vaccine that's designed to help prevent human papillomavirus infection that sometimes, when left untreated, can lead to cervical cancer in some cases. And just to give you an example, there are about 12,000 women a year who are diagnosed with cervical cancer, and 3,000 to 4,000 of those women die. But it takes at least 20 years in the majority of cases for you to get the infection, and then it turns into cancer. 70% of HPV infections will resolve themselves within 1 year. 90% clear up within 2 years with absolutely no problems. And it's only the 10% resultant in persistent infections that we're talking about here. And before I go on, I want to explain that one of the reasons that you really need to be concerned at this point is that there is absolutely no proof whatsoever that using this vaccine will lead to the prevention of cervical cancer. And Diane Harper is a researcher and chemist and biologist and scientist who was on the cutting edge of designing these vaccines. And she has told in numerous media and TV and in magazines that it would take vaccinating every single 12-year-old in the United States for 60 years in order to reduce the rate of cervical cancer at all. And the reason being is that the cervical cancer rate in the United States is already so low due to the Pap testing that there's absolutely no way possible to use this vaccine to reduce cervical cancer. It's a good marketing ploy, but it doesn't work. It's a good drama ploy that Merck and GlaxoSmithKline have pulled on legislators who I have seen crying legislators stand and beg for this vaccine to be mandated in Indiana, for example. And their heart is in the right place, but they've been misled scientifically. What they really should know is that right now there are over 25,000 adverse reports to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which we shortened as VAERS, in connection with HPV vaccines. We have 73 of those reports are Guillain-Barré syndrome, and 111 of them so far from the last time I looked at this system were deaths. Now, the CDC has gone and done their own investigation, and just like they do with all the vaccines, they've said that all of these adverse reports that have been filed with the VAERS have nothing to do with the vaccine. But they often correlate with reports that Merck and GlaxoSmithKline reported in their clinical studies, but kind of whitewashed and explained that, you know, that it really wasn't something that was important. And I'll give you an example. Many of the women and girls who get this vaccine have fainting episodes, have seizures, and they don't often happen right after you get the vaccine. It might happen within the next 24 hours to 48 hours. If you go to the clinical trials, you will find with Merck's vaccine Gardasil, most of the women who died, and I say women because there were no studies on children under 15, most of the women who died in car wrecks. And I actually asked Diane Harper, well, do you know if the women were driving or if they were passengers? And she said, why, they never thought to ask. So how do we know that these women who died weren't actually having seizures due to the vaccine? We don't. The other thing is that we're trying to use a vaccine to solve a problem that isn't. The problem is that the main consistent risk factor for HPV infection is multiple sex partners. Why don't we just teach our children that multiple sex partners is associated with contracting HPV infection, which can lead, in some circumstances, left untreated, to cervical cancer? The other risks are long-term oral contraceptive use. Maybe the CDC and the health officials don't want our kids to know that if you take birth control pills, that this increases your risk for HPV infection. Being infected with HIV, having a low immune system, being on steroid medications or chemotherapy, or having other sexual transmitted diseases also are risk factors, but the primary risk factor is multiple sex partners. And then, contrary to the media reports, you have to remember it takes decades. They keep dragging out a 23-year-old girl here and a 25-year-old one here. But the truth is it takes decades in almost all instances except these few that they've found for the HPV to turn into cervical cancer. And only then, the majority of women who get cervical cancer have not had Pap tests within the last 5 years. Another thing is that when you get this vaccine, you have to know that if you are already positive, meaning already infected with one of the four viruses against which it protects, it doesn't work for you. If you've already been infected, it does not work. Gardasil protects against four HPVs. Two of them protect against genital warts. Genital warts efficacy, meaning how long does it last, starts to wear off after 2.5 years. If you vaccinate boys at 10 and 11 years and they want to not get genital warts at the time they need it when they're becoming sexually active in their mid or late teens, that's not going to work, even if you if they weren't positive for those two HPVs.
Well, Cindy,
the other two,
Cindy, you've written extensively on this, and this is on your website. We're running out of time now, but I just want to do a brief update to let people know that there's another side to the story. And I'm going to invite you back for a more extended version of this so we can go into it in greater depth. And by that time, I'm hopeful to find out exactly why Governor Nikki Haley was opposed to it. And we'll be able to post up your article at that time, all right?
Can I add just one more sentence?
Sure.
Stanford University Medical Center did a cost-effectiveness test for the HPV vaccine, assuming that 100% of 12-year-olds got the vaccine, and they wanted to find out how much extra life you could have if you got this vaccine. Everybody that's thinking of mandating this vaccine needs to know that Stanford University says that the grand total of extra time that you get on your life by taking the risk of this vaccine is 2.8 days.
You're kidding.
Nope.
2.8 days and you could risk dying? Thank you for sharing that, Cindy. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Cindy Bevington, out from Indiana to share an Newsmaker update. I'm Gary Knoll. Before we come up to the end of our program, we take one day a week and we offer you a special so that all the income goes to the station to pay the operating expense, so no one has ever had to spend 1 minute of their time raising funds. And it's a model that works, but we have to select something that people really like. Well, today, this is one of our most popular items, and it's been out of stock for 6 months, so I'm hopeful that you'll find that now's the time to get it. This is my super antioxidant. Buy one, get one free. Now, we know that we need antioxidants, and our first and foremost should be a good, healthy diet with juices. But then, from my perspective, I believe people should be taking supplements because it's that backup and it's giving you a more full-rounded area. This contains all the heavy-duty ones like L-carnosine and lycopene and rosemary leaf and tocotrienols and raspberry leaf powder and the bioflavonoids, red wine concentrate and grape skin extract and Chinese green tea, 200 milligrams, by the way, and cysteine and Q10 and N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, superoxide dismutase, taurine, pycnogenol, licorice, broccoli stem, lutein, cabbage leaf, milk thistle, selenium, copper, quercetin. It's got all these in it. So it's the one antioxidant tablet, vegan tablet, Victorian tablet, 90 capsules, that you know you're getting a full spectrum to help you. So give a call. I'm going to give you a number. You're going to buy one. We're going to give you one free. They're going to go right out. All right? Here is the number to get your buy one, get one free of the super antioxidant, the most powerful, the most well-rounded, the most comprehensive one that I could possibly make. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now, just quickly, at coming up to the end of the program, please contact your senator today and say, vote yes on labeling genetically engineered material. You only want food that has been genetically engineered that has a label on it. And just say that Senator Sanders, who I don't have time to play a segment now, but there's a whole lot of articles just today showing about the genetic engineered politics, the problems with genetic engineering, the problems with the crops, the problems with our health. I'll post those on my website so you can go to progressiveradionetwork.com and read them. We are posting Senator Sanders' 9-minute speech there so you can watch it, but become informed and call today. Today is the day they're voting, and you always turn out in the large numbers to do this, so please do so now. Our final call will be to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann. We have about 4 minutes to go, so I wanted to turn it over to you, and you can ask any of the questions that people reach out to you for.
Okay. Well, first I wanted to just mention we are in our first week of the retreat in Florida, and we are getting ready for our second week. And I actually have one person had to cancel last minute, so I actually have one opening if anyone's interested in coming down here. It is powerful what's going on here. That's all I'm going to say. And we also have one opening for someone who wants to do what we call work study, where you're part of a staff of people that help out. And if you're interested in that, give me a call. I'm at 973-766-2214. That's 973-766-2214. Now, I have an email here from Sarah from Freeport. She says that she saw your documentary last Saturday. She didn't know what to expect. Throughout the movie, she was physically ill. She was very upset. She says, I thought I was informed about the role of health care and the politics and economics of our health care system, she says, but I never put the pieces together the way they were presented. And she, you've got a lot of people writing this, Gary, that's saying they're going to be committing themselves to efforts now to address the issues that were brought up. Very, very positive, very strong reactions from people. One of the things that came up, though, on the Friday night the presentation was, as always, you ask, you know, who's from, where are our teachers? Where are our politicians? And then you asked, where are the people from WBAI? No hand went up. Now, I'm going to tell you, I know that not family don't always get along. And I understand that there could be conflict within families, but I've always felt that I was a part of the BAI family, and I always felt that you were, of course, a part of the BAI family. How is it that these people are supposed to be like family? Why aren't they supporting any of your efforts? That's my question for you.
I can't answer that. You would have to get them to tell you directly, and I don't want to even assume. I've had maybe 22 screenings in New York. I've had 14 rallies that I've helped either lead or help sponsor those who were leading them. And there's never been any of the people showing up for managed murder producers. But understand, I don't care about who doesn't show up. That's their right not to. I care about who does. And I believe that when you look at the fact that we had standing room only at the Ethical Culture Center and out on Long Island and upstate last week and the people at Indian Point, there was no more room. We couldn't have put any more people, thousands of people, and in front of the governor's office and all the other places that we've been. It is the people who care about the issues themselves who show up. I believe the emphasis should be on those who are part of an active future of taking back power to make important choices for themselves. This film is merely one of the tools we can use to educate ourselves. For those who assumed that the governmental agencies and bureaucracies were there to protect us, in fact, we find out that they're doing just the opposite. That's a wake-up call. I could understand how someone can become just ill watching something like that, kind of that nauseous, sick to your stomach because you're seeing a truth that shows that you've been betrayed. And then why is it you're just finding out this point in our life? Again, look at the good part. Isn't it better to be awakened at this moment so you can do something than never to be awakened, where you can then join today by calling with the hundreds of thousands of others, the people in this audience who are going to call today and tell their senator, you vote for Bernie Sanders' labeling of genetic engineered material, a labeling law, or we're not going to vote for you. That's the power of showing up. Now, BAI and its management and producers have every right not to show up. They have every right to sponsor and support or show up for their own events, and therefore it is not my right to either be criticizing them or assuming I understand their motives. It is really irrelevant. To me, it's what we're doing and how we're doing it and who's supporting that's relevant. Thank you for your call. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.